Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of November. And it's all things political for the first hour of our program, which you always hear on Mondays at 9. Always a lot to talk about. The race is considered to be barometers of the president's popularity, that very interesting race in upstate New York. We'll talk about the gubernatorial race in New Jersey, where the president has been campaigning for John Corzine several times. We just heard from NPR that the runoff presidential election in Afghanistan was officially canceled today. There isn't a whole lot of support for Karzai. He, of course, is now the president once again. What does that mean in terms of U.S. strategy in that country? Healthcare reform. Our guest today was quoted in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on the healthcare reform bill that was presented from House Democrats last week, which doesn't include the Senate Finance Committee's proposal to tax high-cost insurance plans. Why not tax the most expensive health insurance plans? We will talk about that. Well, look at the number. I found these polls kind of interesting. The number of people in this country now who consider themselves Republicans and the number who consider themselves Democrats, neither is very high. The Republicans down to 20%, and I think the Democrats are only at 33%. What's going on with that? So those are a few of the topics on the table here. You're welcome to bring forward anything you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that would be okay. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Professor Mordecai Lee, Professor of Governmental Affairs in the School of Continuing Education at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Professor Mordecai Lee, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Kathy.
Hi. Nice to have you here. Let's start with that really wacky race in upstate New York. It's just had twists and turns, and Sarah Palin was involved in it. Tell us, what's the meaning of it?
Well, it's only gotten sporadic coverage over here, but what I think is important to talk about is that Republicans who are ideologically to the right want to purify the party. They want to purge the party of the moderate wing of the party. And so here's what happened. When Barack Obama named the Republican congressman from upstate New York, and by upstate, I mean far upstate, where Fort Drum is. He named the incumbent congressman to be Secretary of the Army, so now there's a special election to fill the seat, and it's a traditionally Republican seat. There wasn't a primary. The Republican county chair selected a nominee of the Republican Party, and she was a moderate Republican. On economic issues, she was a traditional Republican, but on some social issues, she was out of the mainstream of, I guess, what you'd call talk radio Republicanism. Her positions on abortion and gay rights were slightly to the left of the center of the Republican Party. So some ideologically right Republicans decided they would run someone in the general election, which is occurring tomorrow, under the ticket of the Conservative Party. In New York State, there's a separate party called the Conservative Party. Sometimes a candidate has nominations of both parties, sometimes not. So tomorrow there was going to be a three-way race, the Republican, the Conservative, endorsed by Sarah Palin, and the Democrat. And in that kind of a race, the Republican vote is being split. The Republican nominee was running behind, and on Saturday she dropped out of the race, making it a two-person race, and making everybody think that, well, now the conservative sort of closet Republican would win because right. The Republican vote wouldn't be separated. And yesterday she endorsed the Democrat.
Oh, my gosh.
And what I think is interesting here, some of your listeners are Democrats, some of your listeners are Republicans. What's interesting here is the issue of should parties be ideologically pure, should they stand for something, or should parties be a big tent that has a great amount of diversity within them? You could argue it either way, but tomorrow is something of a showdown within the Republican Party, and that's why I think it's so interesting.
Yeah. And what involvement did Sarah Palin have in this race, Mordecai?
Mrs. Palin endorsed the conservative at the time that there was a Republican Party nominee. So in other words, she was saying, I know there's a Republican nominee, I am a Republican, but this Republican nominee is not to my liking in terms of her views on issues, and therefore I'm endorsing the Conservative Party nominee. So one is having, instead of within a party's primary, this sort of selecting out process, we're having it in the general election. If the conservative nominee wins tomorrow, I think he'll redefine himself as a Republican, and then it'll be seen as a kind of a signal for these kinds of primaries all around the country over the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like what happened when Goldwater was the Republican nominee in the mid-60s. If I recall, the slogan of his supporters was something like, "I'd rather be right than win."
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we want ideological purity. We want the Republican Party to be a conservative party.
Frank Rich had an interesting column on all of this yesterday, saying the more rightists who win GOP primaries, the greater the Democrats' prospects next year. Would you agree?
No, I'm really not sure. After all, when Ronald Reagan was running for president against the incumbent president, Jimmy Carter, lots of people said that Ronald Reagan was way too far to the right. There was no way that people would support him. And yet he won overwhelmingly and became an incredibly popular president. So there are times when the American voters seem to care about ideology, and there are other times when they sort of don't care about ideology. I think the same thing happened just a year ago right now when people were voting for Barack Obama against Senator John McCain. I don't think it was so much a rejection of John McCain, but it was a rejection of the Republican control of the White House and, to a lesser extent, of the Congress up to 2 years before. They just really wanted a different party in effect. So American voters are rarely ideological, more often pragmatic, but what's so odd is that America's political parties are highly ideological.
Right. Well, what about, though, the split between so-called moderate Republicans, if there are many right now, and people who are considered very conservative, like Sarah Palin? It seems to me as though those people are extremely ideological, perhaps more so than Ronald Reagan ever was. And a lot of people in the American electorate don't support that kind of ideology.
You're right, Kathleen, but everything sort of depends on the context and the circumstances. For example, you mentioned that tomorrow there's a gubernatorial race in Virginia as well as New Jersey, and the Republican nominee is a very traditional sort of talk radio Republican. But he isn't talking about social issues. But nonetheless, he is within the heart of, I guess, what you call the Sarah Palin wing of the party. So, and in fact, he's the odds-on winner for tomorrow in the Virginia gubernatorial election. So, like I said, sometimes ideology counts to the voters and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. So is that going to be a matter of turnout, Mordecai, in Virginia, or is a Democratic candidate lackluster?
I think it's more in the nature that since the 1970s, Virginia had been a largely Republican state, not all the time, you know, but more often than not, it was Republican, and when Barack Obama carried it in the presidential election, it was the first time in I think it was at least 30 or 40 years that a Democrat had carried it in the presidential election. But more often than not, it's been a red state, and so one would sort of give the odds-on favorite for a Republican nominee to win. If the Democrat won, it would be an incredible upset, but I don't expect that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to New Jersey for a moment. The president has been there several times. Not a whole lot of great enthusiasm for the current governor. Why?
Well, you know, it's really hard to be a governor these days. You've got a financial crisis where invariably you have to engage in fiscal policies that are unpopular. You have to cut spending. You have to increase fees or taxes. Here you've got an incumbent Democratic governor of New Jersey running for re-election, John Corzine. He used to be a U.S. senator, and before that he was on Wall Street. And it's sort of natural that the financial affairs of New Jersey State and the economic condition of New Jersey State in terms of employment are very bad. And so it would tilt against the Democrats. And I think we should sort of expect that the Republican would win, but there is an independent in the race, and so, again, that might throw things off.
Mm-hmm. The Times this morning is saying that, well, specifically this race, but the others, are considered to be barometers of the president's popularity. Are they?
You know, I suppose there is no flat, correct answer. You know, one of the things I like about being an observer of governmental affairs is it's sort of so different from math, because in math, there's only one correct answer. 2 + 2 = 4. Whereas in democracy, it sort of varies. It all depends. And I think some voters might make it a referendum on Barack Obama, but I'm guessing that most voters will make it a referendum on how they feel the state is doing. Not just state government as a an entity, but the state in and of itself, in other words, the economic condition of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised that Barack Obama campaigned for him yesterday because he was sort of putting his pledge on the, his name on the line. But I think that Republicans are going to win, but I'm not sure that means much for, let's say, a year from now. After all, there's a kind of a natural cycle in American politics of things that happen in even-numbered years. It's so unusual that New Jersey and Virginia have gubernatorial elections in the odd-numbered year. I think by 12 months from now, the condition of the economy will be very different, and it'll be fair to judge the off-year elections as a referendum on the president, but I'm not sure this one does.
And the condition of the economy, you expect to be a whole lot better, about the same, or what?
No, I expect it to be better. Unemployment will still be up because, after all, unemployment is what they call a lagging economic indicator as opposed to a leading economic indicator. But I think the mood of the country will be better. The economy will be stronger. I'm guessing the stock market will be better. And all that will lead to people feeling that they feel good about the direction the country is going. You know, it's a really simple question to ask people. You feel good how, then fill in the blank, your city, your state, your country is doing, or do you think it's headed in the wrong direction? And that's often a very powerful signal of how people will vote.
Mm-hmm. What about those unemployment numbers, though, Mordecai? They're very high. What about the president not really taking this on as a challenge? It seems to me as though they need to step in. Those are unacceptably high numbers.
I think this ties back to what we talked about just a few minutes ago in terms of this being a referendum on the president. I think the president's time schedule was not about things being good in the odd-numbered year, but about things getting better in the even-numbered year. I wouldn't be surprised if unemployment is 8, 9, 10% next year, but notwithstanding that, I think the economy will be in better shape, will be coming back, hiring. The trend in hiring will be better, even though as many people will be unemployed. And to a certain extent, you have to let these things work out. Barack Obama is no laissez-faire economist, but he understands that these things have to work their way through the process.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Afghanistan, and then we'll start taking phone calls. It was made official today, just a while ago, that the runoff presidential election was canceled today. Not great enthusiasm in this country or in Afghanistan for Karzai, but he's the guy once again. What does that mean for U.S. strategy, Mordecai?
Gosh, what a mess.
It is a mess, isn't it?
There's a saying about in Washington, none of the easy problems reach the president's desk, because if they're easy, somebody else below him will solve it. Here's a perfect case of where a president has to make a big decision, and he's in a situation of damned if you do and damned if you don't. Public opinion and the facts on the ground seem to call for withdrawing or a minimal participation. On the other hand, this creates a situation of, did all these boys and young women die for nothing? Do we really want to see the Taliban take over again? Is there a political solution as opposed to a military solution? I'm sure glad I don't have to make that decision.
Yeah. I thought that picture so widely distributed, and I know that Liz Cheney made it a political picture of the president saluting the fallen troops was haunting.
Yeah, here's another situation where there is no one correct answer. If a person is inclined to be a Republican, then they would agree with Ms. Cheney that, mm-hmm. You shouldn't have done it. If a person is a Democrat, then they tend to think that Ms. Cheney is off because, after all, why didn't George Bush do it? So it's a perfect situation where people develop positions based on if they're generally speaking right of center or left of center. There just is no correct answer. The president probably knew that no matter what he did, he'd be criticized, in the same way that George Bush knew that whatever he did, he'd be criticized.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just a moment. Mordecai Lee is our guest for All Things Political today, professor of governmental affairs, School of Continuing Education at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Here's our number. One line is open, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's the number again, 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk about searching the net for Car's Eye, brother, and what you get. And I'd start out with a comment that a blogger made, which said that the enemy of my enemy is the guy who screws me in the end. And when you go through the numerous entries that you can find when you enter Car's Eye, brother, on the net, you find out that we knew early and didn't do anything about it in terms of the Car's Eye brothers' involvement with drugs. We know, of course, that the drugs cause a lot of harm and that they help fund the Taliban. We know from a couple of military people that our credibility in the country is probably going to make or break us in terms of establishing any control in the country. And it also reveals on the net that to completely control Afghanistan, we need 500,000 troops. But that the alternate strategy, one alternate strategy proposed is to just control small pockets of the country and hope that people would take the example and then spread it outward further. But it talks about how drugs come from Helmand Province in Afghanistan, and the bridge that allows the drugs to the heroin to go into Kandahar to be spread to the Europe and the United States, the trucks that come through there are charged basically a toll by Karzai's brother, and his control allows the drugs to get through. And a couple of generals in testimony before Congress have already said that, if we don't clean up the government, we're out of luck. Michael Flynn and also Admiral Michael Mullins has testified before the Senate. And it seems to be a real mess, and I don't see any way out of it except to get out.
Mordecai.
That's a great observation. And imagine you're the president, you're sitting in the Oval Office, and somebody says exactly what Jim from Milwaukee just said. In fact, Vice President Biden is the leading advocate within the administration of walking away from Karzai, regardless of the consequences. There's an internal debate going on within the administration right now about what to do, and you're Barack Obama, and somebody says these things just like Jim says, and then I think we can also picture what the other side says. Gosh, what do you do? I don't know what to do.
So you think we ought to just leave Jim now? The sooner the better. Jim is...
You know, Kathleen, you and I are old enough to remember the Vietnam War and remember the protests against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit that this is feeling to me more and more like Vietnam, more and more like it's a quagmire that you can't get out of, that we're staying in for all the wrong reasons, that we're allied with, a corrupt government that really doesn't care about winning the war. I'm just not sure what's going to be happening.
Yeah. And what is the president doing about this? Almost every night you hear, well, he's locked up in the basement with all these advisors talking about what the strategy should be. He's been doing this for weeks now, it seems. Is he just going to listen to every possible opinion he can get on this and then make a decision about strategy, or what's going on?
Well, indeed, the Republicans like Ms. Cheney and her father, former Vice President Cheney, have criticized the president for what they call dithering
mm-hmm.
on the decision. My impression of the decision-making process of President Obama is a very deliberate, fact-based process of sometimes going back and getting more information, of getting more alternatives. What I'm afraid of is, again, going back to the Vietnam analogy, is that the sort of exaggerated joke about President Johnson when he turned to the military and he said, give me some options. And they say, okay, Mr. President, we'll give you three options. You can cut and run, or you can start dropping nuclear bombs, or you can just moderately escalate the number of U.S. troops, as though that's some kind of compromise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really afraid of what is depicted as a compromise to the president.
Yeah. Let's go next to Ken from Madison. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I am interested in knowing why the two of you have basically elected to characterize the New York congressional race as the Sarah Palin story. You've both brought up her name multiple times. If you mentioned the actual candidates at all, it was in passing, and I don't think I caught them if you did. It seems to me the story would be exactly the same if she had never chosen to offer an endorsement. There have been many other endorsements on both sides, and the story would be exactly the same without her. And I am intrigued as to why the two of you, unprompted, have basically portrayed this as a Sarah Palin story.
I think that's a great comment. I suppose when we talk about the news, we're always looking for shorthand ways of depicting something. And so one of the reasons is probably because she's viewed as such a standard bearer for the conservative wing of the party that her endorsing against the Republican nominee is news. I suppose another reason is because she's going to be in Milwaukee in Wisconsin next week, and so that makes it more relevant. But generally speaking, whether we're talking about Mrs. Palin or anybody else, this is a very interesting dynamic about ideologues wanting to purge their party, almost in the same way that Franklin Roosevelt tried to purge the Democratic Party of the conservative wing back in the 1938 congressional election, and by the way, failed miserably. So this is the argument about whether parties should be ideologically uniform or be a bigger tent.
Yeah. Well, my understanding, Ken, just from the press that I've seen on all of this, and maybe it's all erroneous, is that she did play a big role here, that what she had to say was extremely important and perhaps more important than what others said.
Well, it was my understanding that this battle was well underway and it shaped up exactly the same way without that. Many prominent Republicans had come in on both sides. Dick Armey campaigned with the conservative candidate, apparently fairly ineptly.
Right.
And again, Sarah Palin's PR organization has often seemed inept, but on this one, if they did this deliberately, they're doing it fantastically because they've got the two of you here in Wisconsin treating this as the Sarah Palin story, and it seems to me that she really is peripheral to it, and I question whether it should have been presented that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see your point. I'm not sure if she's peripheral or not, but she's still with us, isn't she, Mordecai? She's still here. Thanks, Ken, very much for your call. It was good. Bill from Harshaw is next. Hi, Bill.
Morning.
Morning.
Thanks for the program. I was just interested in your guest's opinion as to Obama's strategy of having a lot of Republicans in his administration, and if it's helping him, you know, so-called reaching across the aisle. I don't feel that it is. In fact, I think it's hurting him. And I'm just wondering what his opinion is on that strategy of Obama.
Well, looking back on history, one generally sees presidents, whether they're Democratic or Republican, appointing some number of people from the other party, not necessarily to prove they're bipartisan to everybody, but just as a kind of a signal of bipartisanship. After all, the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of War during World War II under Franklin Roosevelt were Republicans, and right now under Secretary Obama, President Obama's Secretary of Defense Gates is the carryover secretary from the Bush administration. Actually, for this congressional race, the Secretary of the Navy used to be a powerful position when it was a cabinet department. Now it's actually a pretty low-level position, and I was sort of surprised that an incumbent congressman would take the job because the Secretary of the Navy is not in the chain of command and is merely the civilian head of a unit within the Department of Defense. So I guess Barack Obama is just following a pattern, and whether it successfully proves that he's bipartisan or not, or whether it successfully holds, is you're right, a wholly different matter.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Scott from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. Just two quick points. One, I guess I wanted to echo that caller's opinion about bringing Sarah Palin in and kind of put forth the idea that you referred to the Virginia Republican candidate as the talk radio Republican, and that seems to be the narrative out there that the Republicans are always the extremists. I never hear anybody ever refer to Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid as the talk radio, you know, speaker or leader of the Senate.
Well, Scott, we're talking about the races for tomorrow.
I know, but that seems to be the narrative all the time, that, you know, the Republicans are the extremists and the Democrats are the moderate mainstream. But my question was,
I think there's a bit of symmetry in the parties, in the sense that the Republican Party is largely the conservative party, but it has a moderate wing. Similarly, the Democratic Party is the left-of-center liberal party with a small conservative wing. So I suppose we could talk about You know, in talk radio, it's not symmetrical. Talk radio is predominantly right of center. But it's fair to talk about, you know, Keith Olbermann Democrats, or to refer to people as MSNBC Democrats. That would certainly be as colorful and descriptive a shorthand as describing Republicans as, let's say, Rush Limbaugh Republicans.
Right. And I agree with that. It just, it seems to be the narrative in the media. It doesn't ever get explained that way as... I mean, you have the Republicans, the narratives, Republicans extreme, conservative bad, Democrats moderate good, and that seems to be the narrative. But my main question is, has to do with health care, and I'm wondering how this bill that, if there's going to be something passed, which seems to be fairly minimal in size, is going to impact the next election cycle. It seems Barack Obama's in trouble on both sides. One, he's not far enough on it for his base, and he's too far for... And then you have a situation with this swine flu, this vaccine shortage, where, gosh, I really remember in 2004 how we had a vaccine shortage. It was actually George Bush's fault and his administration's fault that we didn't have enough vaccine. So I started hearing people talk about that as, well, if he can't handle the vaccine situation, Ma, how's he going to control health care? Just my thoughts.
Right. Scott, I guess what I'd say is that with the off-year elections occurring 12 months from today, or roughly from today, that a year in politics is just an eternity. And the things that we're arguing about today may or may not be big a year from now, and may or may not break Republican or break Democratic. For example, I think it's unclear, assuming a health care bill passes, I think it's unclear if it'll be an advantage for Republicans or an advantage for Democrats. After all, what we're talking about is not people who self-identify, I'm almost always a Republican or I'm almost always a Democrat, but we're talking about the independent voters. A year from now, will independent voters think that health care bill really was a good idea, or will the independent voters say that health care bill has become a mess and my premiums have gone up and I'm mad about it? I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. Tim from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I guess my comment first is for the Republican in New York 23 to have dropped out and then endorse the Democrat doesn't really make sense to me, because the best way for her to have helped the Democrat would have been to stay in the race and siphon votes off of the conservative. And my question is, given the strength of these Tea Party folks, do you think that that is an ominous sign for Congressman Petri in the 6th here in Wisconsin?
Let me try to deal with both of them quickly. My impression, and it's simply from reading the New York Times, so you can discount my opinion based on that. My impression was that on Saturday when she dropped out, she had seen some polls that showed that she was not only coming in third, but she was sinking fast. And so had she stayed in the race, it would not necessarily have broken the way in the scenario that Tim mentioned. The Tea Party thing is related to New York 23 because it's sort of an issue of nationalizing the parties versus parties representing local concerns. Republican candidate who has now dropped out was seen as sort of more reflective of local issues, and in fact, I think the Watertown newspaper said that, whereas the Conservative Party candidate is seen as a person who represents this national conservative trend and discounts local issues much more. So in that respect, this is, a fascinating phenomenon.
Let's talk a little bit more about health care. You were quoted in today's paper concerning this difference between the health care reform bill from the House and that it doesn't include the Senate Finance Committee's proposal to tax high-cost insurance plans. The tax, you say, could have a bigger effect on areas with higher health care costs, such as Southeast Wisconsin, than other parts of the state or the country, not having a whole lot of political appeal. You want to elaborate, Mordecai?
Sure. When I was in politics, I sort of felt like I was running. I was in high school and I was running in a popularity contest. And so every day I wanted to win a popularity contest so that when the election came around, I'd win election. That actually pretty closely captures how the world looks to an elected official. You want to be popular. You want to do things that people like, and
You don't want to do things that people wouldn't like. And so the politics of the health care in terms of the, what's called the Cadillac tax is that this would affect some people a bit negatively. And the question is, do politicians want to affect anybody negatively? Generally speaking, the farther this bill has gone, the more and more of the big controversial downside issues have been stripped from the bill. And I think the Cadillac tax is probably the next one. And the bill might end up being, you know, pretty modest if it doesn't take on really big issues. But politicians don't like to turn to people and say, here's what I've taken away from you. They want to say, here's what I've given you, or here's what I've protected that you have.
Mm-hmm.
When people have something taken away from them by political decision-making, you know, a tax break or the level of their taxes, they remember it. They don't go for some big-picture perspective of, well, in the long run, we thought this was a good idea. They say, you affected me, my taxes have gone up, I'm mad at you, I'm voting against you. And that's the politics of health care reform.
When are we likely to get everything reconciled? Maybe that's a wrong word here. When are we likely to get everything worked out between the House and the Senate and have some kind of reform, whatever it might be? Is it going to be soon, do you think?
Well, I think that politicians in both parties realize that the longer the bill debate is strung out, the more opposition will develop and the more controversial things will be stripped from the bill. That's, for example, why we see Republicans emphasizing that this cuts Medicare spending, for example. They're trying to generate opposition from Medicare beneficiaries or future Medicare beneficiaries. So I think the strategy on the part of the majority party, the Democrats, will be to pass it by Christmas, whereas the strategy of the Republicans will be to string it out just absolutely as long as they can.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Carol. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. I'm calling about the war in Afghanistan. I know my opinion is the same as a lot of other people, that President Obama should just bring all the boys and whoever we have over their home, because that is a never-ending war. That war will be going on for till eternity. It's been since the Bible days, and it's never going to end. So I think it's time to come home.
Yeah, I suspect that Carol represents the cutting edge of public opinion, that when there was a major U.S. effort in Iraq and Afghanistan, after all, a year ago, it was Barack Obama saying, we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan, I want to focus on Afghanistan. But now that things are going bad in Afghanistan, public opinion is shifting to, let's get out of there, let's cut our losses. In politics, it's really hard to make big decisions, sort of firm, unambiguous decisions. Politicians tend to want to gravitate to the center to try to please as many sides as they can. And that's why I think it's sort of unlikely the Carol scenario is going to happen, at least overtly, although in a de facto sense, that might happen over the next 12 months to 24.
More phone calls in a moment. All Things Political is what you're listening to this hour on the Ideas Network. Mordecai Lee is our guest. He is professor of governmental affairs in the School of Continuing Education at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. This is a regular feature for us on every Monday at 9 o'clock, and we're looking at tomorrow's elections in various states, and we're talking about Afghanistan and health care reform, all of that. Welcoming your calls, and a couple lines are open now at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, we'll be talking about minority access and preparation for college. The director of Pathways to College, established 4 years ago here in Milwaukee, which started at the Wisconsin Lutheran College, is designed to assist lower-income first-generation students who have the potential to succeed in college. We'll talk with the director, and we'll also speak with the founder of Capital Prep Magnet School in Hartford, Connecticut, and the principal of that school has become nationally known for graduating almost everybody in the high school to go on to four-year colleges. So that's coming up, hour number two. Mordecai Lee here this hour, All Things Political, 800-486-8655. Ann from Madison, hello.
Hi. Something I don't think the public realizes, because these bills are thousands of pages long, is that every single one under consideration by Congress right now would prevent the states from setting up their own single-payer or equivalent system. And Wisconsin's one of the states that has had, you know, has been treating elderly people and children, and you know, has a good chance, and I believe is considering to some extent this kind of system. These would all prevent that, so there wouldn't be anywhere for people to go. They would be forced to buy insurance, except the people who would have to declare themselves paupers, which is very undignified. I think that. You know, and Obama has made deals with the drug companies so that if they say supposedly save the public something like $87 billion over the next 10 years, they won't be limited as to how much they can charge. And I think what we're being, you know, what's being presented to us as change is a pig with lipstick on it, to quote Sarah Palin. And I don't think that all change is good. You can have good change and you can have disastrous change. And change per se is not necessarily good. I would urge people to call their members of Congress to look up whatever they can get, more than a summary of these bills, and say that we're being deceived because members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, are getting so much money from the insurance industry and the rest of the medical industry, that they're about to pass off, you know, forcing people to pay for private insurance to the companies that have defrauded us. And this is, I don't believe this has ever been done anywhere in the world. It's a kind of public-private so-called partnership that is, you know, it's a deal with the devil. I really think this is a terrible, terrible thing, and people better wake up and you know, think about it.
You know, Kathleen, this is why I love Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's always such a pleasure to participate and to listen when I'm driving. But we've had callers on different sides of the health care issue. In this case, Ann from Madison, very articulate about her support for single-payer. So try to imagine oneself being a congressman or being a U.S. senator, and you're hearing from the Anns of the world, and you're hearing from people on the other side. You're trying to make a decision. You don't want to make anybody angry at you, or at least you want to minimize the number of people who'll be angry at you. These are tough political situations, and I think this program has helped capture the reality of what it's like to be in Washington right now.
Yeah. Thanks, Ann, so much for your call. We go to Angela from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the impression that the Republican strategy right now is to simply block everything that the Democratic administration is putting forward. And that may just be my perspective at the moment. But is that actually the strategy of the Republicans? And if it is, what are the Democrats doing to combat it?
You know, I think it's fair to say that both parties in the U.S. Senate and Congress are much more homogeneous internally than they used to be, and that things are much more partisan than they used to be. There are many more party line votes, pure partisan votes, compared to, let's say, 30, 40 years ago. And I think it's fair to say that any opposition party, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, their goal is to sort of stop the machine or slow down the machine. I remember when the Democrats were the minority party in the state Senate, which is obviously quite different from U.S. Congress, and they use parliamentary procedure to slow things down. That's what the loyal opposition does. They want to show up the majority party. But I think Angela is right that right now in the U.S. Senate, there are more frequent times when Republicans will require that what's called a cloture vote, a vote to cut off debate, has to occur, even on what we would probably consider relatively minor issues. And that's why the number 60 has become so important, that whenever Republicans require that for a bill to get voted on, you have to successfully pass cloture, then that means that really to govern the Senate, you need 60 votes as opposed to a majority of 51. And that has changed the dynamic of party debate on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
Do you want to comment briefly, Mordecai, because it kind of fits in with what we're saying, on these polls that show that party identification for Republicans, a mere 20%, not much better for Democrats, 33%. Why is it so low, and what does it mean for the running of the country? Anything? Does it make a difference?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful insight. And in fact, it seems that it's a phenomenon of our time that when people are asked, what's your party identification, that there seems to be this sort of secret signal that we've all had this sort of secret conference call, and the correct answer to that question is, I'm an independent.
Right.
You know, I vote the person, I don't vote the party. And I suppose that's really deep in the DNA of American political culture, that we like to think of ourselves as being very pragmatic people, non-ideological people. And what I like about talking about this phenomenon is it shows the disharmony between the reality of political parties and where the voters are, because political parties are ideology machines nowadays. The Democratic Party is a left-of-center party with very few conservatives. The Republican Party is a right-of-center party with very few minorities. And I misspoke, very few moderates. Yet here, that so in Congress, with an electorate that's saying that that at least 50% of us don't like a party label. I think this will lead to interesting things, and that's one of the reasons why it's fun to observe politics.
Angela, thanks for your call. Tom from Burlington, hi.
Good morning. One of the sad points in this whole conversation is we have 100 million people who don't bother to vote. 100 million Americans call themselves Americans and don't go to the polls. And another sad thing is in the foreign countries, voting day is a national holiday. It's either on a day that everybody votes, or some countries have it set up. If you don't vote, I think you get a fine of some kind. But what I'd like to point out is I was a page in Washington, and I was getting on the elevator one time, and these two congressmen were talking about, well, how are you going to vote and what are you going to do? And he says, well, I don't really know how to vote because I didn't get any letters from my person. And one person said this, and I'll never forget that, as a matter of fact. And people do, your letters are important, and talking to your congressman is, I mean, any way you can is important. But what I'd like to do, why don't we in this country figure out, we have a shortage of 300,000 doctors in America right now. There's a shortage of 300,000. And what is this? Is this a systemic problem? Is it a deliberate problem? Is it a curriculum problem? How come we have made the thing of being a doctor such a mystery, like a medicine man or somebody, or even a head of these guys who are getting these big salaries running these Wall Street firms? So that's one of the things we might look at. And the next thing is, why don't we look at the countries, and we're in this wonderful position now where we can set up this medical plan by looking at all the other countries and looking what they've done and taking the best of this and the best of that and working with it. And when they talk about this thing of letting government do this and government do that, we allowed the post office to have a monopoly on selling or on delivering mail, but we also allowed for private companies like FedEx and United Parcel to have an entry in there and to compete with them. And originally, the post office handled 90% of your parcel post. Now they only handle about 20%. Now with our health plan.
All right, let's hold it there, Tom, because we have other callers, and you brought up a number of areas. Mordecai.
Going backwards, and I'll only address two issues. The post office indeed is a monopoly, and a lot of people complain that it's an unfair monopoly in the sense that, yes, FedEx and UPS can exist, but they're prohibited from putting anything in a person's mailbox. The mailbox is treated not as an individual citizen's possession, but rather it's treated as a kind of an extension of the government. And so there have been efforts to undo that monopoly so that other competitors can put things in one's mailbox. The only other thing I'll mention is in terms of the doc shortage, I'm guessing that it's perhaps partly a doc shortage in raw numbers, but perhaps even more a maldistribution, both both geographically and in terms of specialties, that we don't have enough docs in rural areas. We don't have enough docs who are GPs. They tend to gravitate to cities and to the high-earning specialties. So that is probably one of the many aspects of reforming healthcare.
Thanks, Tom. Burnell, is it, from Minnesota? Hi, Burnell.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two quick things. Number one, the medical plan that Obama's pushing really hard has all kinds of attachments that does not have anything to do with medical. And one of my things that just irritate me to no end is how Congress, our senators and congressmen who are supposed to be lawmakers, are leaving things go through with attachments to them that have nothing to do with medical, and which could bring our bills up even higher.
What upsets you about the plan on the table?
There was a program, and they were talking about all of the other attachments on the medical.
Okay.
And it had where we were going to have to pay more for different things. And if it's a medical bill, it should have medical attachments. It shouldn't have, we're going to build this new building in this other state.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do buildings, then do a plan or do a bill on building things, whether it's roads or buildings, you know, construction, whatever. But don't attach that to a medical plan mm-hmm. to pass something else. We're worrying about, are people getting the medical that they need and the price of it? If you're going to attach something to a medical plan, then put a restriction on how much you can have to pay for your medical plan.
Are there going to be a lot of attachments to whatever gets worked out in healthcare reform, Mordecai?
The answer, and Burnell will be disappointed by that, is yes. And I think, again, we have to talk about how the world looks from through the eyes of a politician. You know, if you're a member of Congress or you're a U.S. senator and, you know, you're getting pressure to vote for it, you're getting pressure to vote against it, the majority leader eventually picks up the phone and calls you and says, okay, what is it going to take to get you on this bill?
Mm-hmm.
What will tilt it so that you do that? And sometimes, Burnell is right, people will say things that don't relate to the main topic of the bill. They might say, you know, I want this building built, I want this highway built. And the if you're the majority leader, you're expedient, you're counting votes, and you know that philosophically and in terms of public policy, this is a lousy way to pass legislation. But it's the only way to pass legislation. And so ultimately, that's why we see these what are called Christmas tree bills, because they have so many ornaments hanging from them, and they sort of weigh down the boughs of the tree.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Burnell, for the call. Steve is next. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. I heard the caller previous to the one that was just on who was making a complaint about people who aren't voting, and I guess I wanted to add my two cents on that. You know, I wasn't public about it, but I was enthusiastically in support of President Obama. I went to Eau Claire when he came to speak, and there were just phenomenal lines, you know. And now we're not quite a year in, but there seems to be so many deals cut with people that just run counter to what the message was a year ago. And so whether it's you get Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers in there who are of the crowd that I think were the problem, part of the problem, or you get a desire, which is not bad for bipartisanship, that's fine, but bipartisanship ought to be bipartisanship and not this veiled effort like this Gang of Six or whatever, where they're undercutting all the time. Eventually you cut bait and you know, you get on with it. So you get disgusted. You get the feeling that what's the point in voting anymore? Because you hear a message and there's no follow through with it, really.
Mordecai.
I think it was Will Rogers who said there are two things in life you shouldn't see being made. One is laws, the other one is sausages. And he's right. Steve is right. the legislative process is a compromise machine. It's a machine that sort of seeks support. And so here we've got the contrast between candidate Obama, who was very idealistic and stated things that really moved a majority of the voters, including Steve, and now he's president, and now he has to make compromises. And this is, in a sense, the reality of public policymaking in Washington, and really the reality of how in a democracy we make decisions.
Thanks very much for the call. Mordecai, a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Kathleen. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Mordecai Lee, our guest this hour, professor of governmental affairs at in the School of Continuing Education at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And just for your edification, we do All Things Political every Monday at 9 o'clock, so you can mark that if you're a political person. We'd love to have you participate. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Jalema Noel for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. We also want to remind you that we are now on Facebook. Da-da-da. We are high tech. And if you'd like more information, you can become a fan if you'd like. And I'm going to look at all of this more today to figure out how we can all talk to each other some. To become a fan, www.wpr.org, and then you search around and find Kathleen Dunn, and then we'll be friends. News is coming up.